We're going to take a bunch of dinner tonight, so if you're interested, I guess we'll be there for a place to get determined at 6:30.
Sounds good. It's nice to be back in Canada. I was postdoc at CETA for 3 years, but back at the old alma mater, Caltech. And today I'm going to be talking about work that's been will be presented in a paper about to be put on the archive, the first half of the talk. It's a work that I've done in collaboration with Guli Lockhart, who is an undergrad at Caltech, one of my summer students, and Sterl Finney, who's faculty at Caltech. And then the second half of the talk, we'll deal with another two papers, one of which was put in the archive on February and just got accepted to PRD, the other of which I put in the archive a week ago Monday. This is work I did with Uli Strahaki, who's a postdoc at Caltech, and then Manuela Liberti, who was formerly a postdoc at JPL and is now faculty at Mississippi. And both of these talks, even though they're kind of unrelated, have to do with the predicting final spins from binary black hole mergers. So an outline for people that aren't as familiar with the subject. What do we mean by a binary black hole merger? We're considering the fundamental problem is two black holes, most likely spinning. We assume that their orbit has been circularized due to gravitational radiation when we begin considering the situation. There's an in-spiral stage where the black holes orbit each other. They radiate gravitational radiation, which carries energy and angular momentum away from the system. The binary separation decreases. They ultimately merge and form a final black hole. And this final black hole will also generally be spinning. And in addition, if the gravitational radiation is not emitted isotropically during the merger, but's preferentially emitted in one direction, conservation of angular momentum implies that the final black hole will recoil with respect to the center of mass of the binary. So in general, the black hole will be recoiling as well. The first half of the talk, the work I did with Guli and Sterl, will focus on a new theoretical limit to the maximum spin of black holes produced in binary mergers. I'm going to begin with a little history of understanding the maximum spins black holes can achieve. I'll describe my new calculation briefly, and I'll say what this perturbation theory calculation of the test particle limit implies for comparable mass black hole mergers. In the second half of the talk, I'm going to consider not aligned black holes where the initial spins are aligned with the orbital angular momentum, but the more general case where the spins can be are not necessarily aligned with the orbital angular momentum. And in this case, the binary spins will precess during this in-spiral prior to merger. And it turns out for astrophysically realistic initial conditions, this precession will be such as to align the black hole spins with each other prior to merger. And this has implications for the final spins you'd expect and these recoil velocities that one would expect as well. Let's go to the first half of the talk. Spinning black holes. Roy Kerr in 1963 discovered the unique stationary axisymmetric vacuum solution to Einstein's equations. This is the metric for that solution. And it's described by two parameters, m here, which is the mass of the hole, and a in these units, which are the units I'll use throughout this talk, g, Newton's constant, and c, the speed of light, equal 1, in which case this angular momentum has units of mass squared. A is essentially the angular momentum divided by the mass of a black hole, so that has dimensions of mass. And this quantity that's alternately referred to as either A star or chi is the dimensionless spin of the black hole. It's the spin angular momentum of the black hole divided by the mass squared, and it's dimensionless. And according to this Kerr solution, this spin angular momentum cannot take on arbitrarily large values. For a Schwarzschild black hole, which is not spinning, the singularity is a point at the center of the event horizon. As the spin angular momentum of the black hole increases, the singularity becomes a ring, still concealed within the event horizon. When this dimensionless spin gets above this Kerr limit, when it gets above 1, the singularity is now exterior to the event horizon. So you'd have a naked singularity, which is, by definition, not a black hole. So black holes, theoretically, can have any spin up to this Kerr limit. The question is whether or not black holes in nature actually saturate this Kerr limit. So James Bardeen in 1970 argued that they could saturate this limit. And so he considered how you might grow a black hole by having material freely falling from its innermost stable circular orbit, or what he referred to as the MS, marginally stable orbits, into the black hole. Is there a question? Please feel free to interrupt questions at any time.
I have a question.
Sure.
When did people switch from MS to E squared?
I don't know. Kip Thorne still talks about MS. I've been using ISCO since I've been in science.
When I was at graduate school, I did MS, but then right after that, everybody was saying ISCO.
Probably depends who your advisor was and where you are. Maybe there might be an East Coast, West Coast thing. I don't know. Maybe we could try to go back to Marshall State Football Field before that. It's two less letters, right?
East Coast is more classy for some reason.
Yeah. MS could mean all the things, I guess. So the idea is that we're considering a freely falling test particle of mass delta M naught falling in from this innermost stable circular orbit onto the black hole. And the black hole's mass due to this process will increase by an amount delta M, which depends on E dagger MS. That's the energy per unit test particle mass on this largely stable or ISCO orbit, which this E dagger of MS is a function of the dimensionless spin of the larger black hole. And the angular momentum of your large black hole will increase by an amount delta J, also proportional to the test particle mass, which depends on the orbital angular momentum per unit test particle mass at the ISCO. So given that the freely falling particle increases the mass and spin angular momentum of your black hole by this amount, you can easily derive a differential equation for how this dimensionless spin we talked about earlier changes as we increase the logarithm of the mass of our black hole. And it turns out that for this differential equation, you can show that if you begin with a black hole of mass mi, that's non-spinning, by the time it grows to a final mass m final, which is the square root of 6 times that initial mass, if you're accreting on equatorial orbits, you can spin all the way up from a non-spinning black hole to this maximum Kerr limit of A dagger equals 1. Kip Thorne then in 1974 argued that you couldn't really achieve this maximum Kerr limit. And he considered the case, rather than just test particles that somehow magically arrived at the ISCO, he's considering a black hole that's growing by accretion in a thin Shakura-Sunyaev accretion disk in the equatorial plane of our spinning black hole. In order for the material to get down to the ISCO where it can freely fall inwards, it has to shed the angular momentum it had on larger radii. The way it does that is viscosity transports angular momentum through the disk. The material moves inwards. As it falls deeper into the gravitational potential well of the black hole, a gravitational binding energy is released. That energy is generally radiated as photons. These photons can either escape to infinity, or they can be absorbed by the black hole itself. And it turns out that some of these radiated photons that are captured by the black hole, you'll preferentially capture photons whose angular momentum is retrograde with respect to that of the spinning black hole. So the fact that you're preferentially absorbing retrograde photons instead of prograde photons means that the radiation is exerting a negative torque on your spinning black hole. And your black hole will reach an equilibrium spin when this negative torque exerted by the photons is balanced by the positive torque once the material actually falls inwards from the ISCO, like we saw before.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
About this slide? So what happens when you reach this limit at
root 6
initial, and then you accrete one more part?
When you've grown
to root 6 initial, and now you're
You're at a maximally spinning black hole, yes.
And then you accrete the next particle, or do you go over
the limit? No, absolutely not. This when dA star dL and M is a function of A star. When A star is 1, that's when you're at this Kerr limit. The ratio of orbital angular momentum per unit test particle mass to binding energy per test particle mass is such that this goes to 0. So Rob Walls, who I guess is visiting here, showed that if you just consider either null or time-like geodesics, it's impossible for a black hole to accrete something that pushes it above the Kerr limit.
People try to love things.
Yeah, getting above the Kerr limit, it's kind of an open question in the case of binary black hole mergers in numerical relativity, but for test particles moving on geodesics of Kerr, you can show that you can't.
The mass certainly keeps growing,
and the mass is growing, and the physical angular momentum is growing, but the dimensionless A star, which is S over M squared, is fixed at 1. So we were saying, Kip was arguing that you won't. Not only can you not go above 1, but you won't actually reach 1. There's going to be a balance due to the fact that this radiation is essentially exerting a negative torque when you're spinning black hole. here we can look at that more carefully. This on this axis here, we have R in units of M, the relativist units people use. This is a spinning black hole, which is at that limit that Kip found, which is a spin of 0.9982. Here we're looking at the flux in radiation emitted as a function of R for our spinning black hole through this accretion disk. This solid curve here is the total, the accumulated fraction of the energy emitted. And so you have a negative torque both due to the fact that at large distances, you're preferentially absorbing photons with retrograde angular momentum. And then at very small distances, once you're in the ergosphere of your spinning black hole, even the radiation getting off to infinity can carry away extra energy and angular momentum from the spinning black hole. So a combination of those two effects leads to a negative torque due to the radiation. This is essentially showing how the dimensionless spin of your black hole is changing. This is a negative of that radiation torque. This is the positive torque due to the matter falling inwards from the ISCO. And you reach an equilibrium value where these two torques balance, which is a dimensionless spin of about 0.998. Now, whereas the energy and angular momentum at the ISCO are well defined, this negative torque due to the radiation does depend to some extent on the radiation flow. Here we're considering two cases. I is the isotropic case, in the case that you're just a particle that's co-moving in the accretion disk. Radiation is being emitted from the surface of the disk isotropically, versus the electron scattering case, where you're preferentially emitting radiation in the perpendicular direction to the disk. So clearly the directionality of the photons being emitted determines what fraction of those photons are actually absorbed by the black hole, what kind of negative torque they exert in the black hole, and then where this balance occurs depends on that. Here we see how the limiting spin is achieved. In the Bardeen case that we looked at, based on Bardeen's 1970 paper, as you increase the mass of the black hole, it's accreting. Its dimensionless spin, a dagger, can go all the way up essentially to unity when you reach radical 6, which is around here, times your initial mass. Depending on whether you're these two different choices for the intensity of the radiation, rather than going all the way up to this maximally spinning limit, you asymptote to this finite value, which is in some measure very close to unity, but in other measures significantly different. For example, the binding energy per unit test particle mass at the ISCO for a hole of this spin compared to a maxly spinning hole, here it's about, the binding energy is about 40% of the rest mass, here it's about 30% of the rest mass. So in terms of the actual efficiency of, luminous efficiency of your spinning black hole, this is a very big difference, the difference between 0.998 and 1. So this is the limit determined by Kip in 1974, and we wanted to consider how fundamental is this limit. We saw already that it depends to some extent on the intensity distribution of the radiation in our disk. So the extreme case might be, what if you were able to supply rest mass to the ISCO without radiating? Photons at any rate. You need to get rid of the energy and the angular momentum somehow to get down to the ISCO. And we're considering, what if you do it in binary black hole mergers, where the emission mechanism is not a viscous disk that's radiating, but is gravitational radiation. And this is...
So in Kip Thorne's calculation, the idea was to neglect any radiation that happened after. It still assumes that whatever energy you have at the ISCO, all energy...
He still assumes that his accretion disk goes, there's no accretion disk interior to the ISCO.
So there's no radiation.
And there's no, the material essentially, once it reaches the ISCO, it falls in on nearly up the plunge into black holes like an orbital time. So that's essentially not significant, the radiation in that point. He's just considering what is happening to the radiation emitted at larger radii, and how does that compare to the torque supplied by the matter actually freely falling in from the ISCO. So this, this binary black hole case is kind of a different problem. For photons, this is a very hot accretion disk. The wavelength of your photons is very short compared to the horizon of your black hole. They're emitted incoherently, and you can essentially consider each of these photons individually. You can just say they're massless particles. They travel on null geodesics. What fraction of those null geodesics make it off to infinity, and what fraction of them are absorbed by the black hole? And that's how you calculate the negative torque. Whereas with gravitational radiation, when your test particle is on an orbit that has some radius r larger than the ISCO, and hence larger than the horizon of the hole itself, the typical wavelength of the gravitational waves is comparable to the radius of the orbit, which is long compared to the horizon. So you just can't consider, you can't trace geodesics for these long wavelengths. You have to do a different kind of calculation to determine what fraction of the gravitational wave energy is absorbed by the spinning black hole. And the way you do that calculation is black hole perturbation theory. This is Einstein's equation, which I won't bother to explain to you guys. It's basically, I got geometry on the left-hand side. This is the Einstein tensor. The stress energy tensor is on the right-hand side. The two are related. In the test particle limit, you can consider the background space-time to be the Kerr metric. And you consider the background, and then there's perturbations about the Kerr metric, which are gravitational waves. And then the right-hand side, Kerr for outside the black hole is just vacuum, and the perturbations to the vacuum is just the stress energy sourced by our tiny test particle that's moving inwards on circular orbits. All the geometry due to these perturbations is captured by psi 4, which is just a contraction of the Weyl tensor, which is the vacuum component of the Riemann tensor, into a series of null tetrahedrons. Psi 4 is a complex scalar whose real and imaginary parts encode the plus and cross polarizations of the gravitational waves. And so the idea is to linearize our Einstein equation and relate these gravitational waves described by psi 4 to the source given by our orbiting test particle. And the equation that describes how this perturbations evolves is the Tolkowski equation. The Einstein equation was nonlinear and difficult to solve. Tucholsky's equation is linear and separable. We decompose psi 4 into harmonics. The angular distribution is given by these quantities here, minus 2 s a omega lm. This is,
sorry, I think I missed what the significance of this psi 4 thing.
The significance, it is essentially how you describe gravitational perturbations. It's the gravitational waves.
Okay, so the metric you decide to work with this.
Instead of using the metric explicitly, we use this complex scalar, which is all the indices are contracted, so it's gauge independent and has advantages.
What is N and M?
N, M bar, N, and M bar here. These are, you know, there's this thing called the Newman-Penrose formalism, which says at each point in space-time, you can construct four null vectors that span the four-dimensional space. And these are elements in those null tetrahedrons. It's contracting these null four vectors at each point in space-time into the Weyl tensor to get a complex scalar that encodes what you would normally use a tensor to describe your gravitational waves. It's more efficient to describe it in a scalar.
So these are for your background metric?
Yes, these can be determined from your, the background is just a Kerr metric.
So N is basically R plus T, it's sort of the outgoing null vector,
sure,
and M and M dagger are the two transverse.
But my point is that
plus, with a plus iron.
C does have the perturbations in it.
Yes.
But N and M don't have perturbations.
No.
That's
okay.
Fine.
Gotcha.
And so we've decomposed our scalar psi 4 into tensor spherical harmonics, which describe the angular dependence, and the radial part, RLM omega, whose evolution is given by a linearized version of Einstein's equation. Again, just like Einstein, we have geometry on the left, stress energy on the right. Now, on the left, we have the radial component of psi 4, which is describing the geometry, describing the gravitational waves. And on the right, we have this tau ln omega, which is a decomposition of the stress energy tensor due to our particle on a circular equatorial orbit. And from the solutions to the Tucholsky equation, you can calculate the gravitational wave fluxes that make it out to infinity and the gravitational wave fluxes propagating inward to the event horizon of the black hole. We actually calculated the energy and angular momentum fluxes using this Gremlin code, where Gremlin stands for gravitational radiation and extreme mass ratio limit, which was developed by Scott Hughes in 2000. He lent it to us. And one of the interesting features of this gravitational radiation is it is, for highly spinning black holes like the ones we're considering, it's super radiantly scattering. The gravitational radiation for a particle orbiting at some orbit of radius r, some fraction of that radiation moves inward. It scatters off of the potential of your spinning black hole, and then it makes it out to infinity with larger amplitude than it had when it was coming in. And so it's carrying away, it's extracting energy and angular momentum from the black hole. And that's what we're calculating here. We're assuming the particle starts off at some large radius, like essentially infinity. These things converge. When you do it numerically, they converge very quickly with large r. The particle inspirals from infinity down to some radius r. We calculate using the code to solve the Tucholsky equation, the energy and angular momentum fluxes down, going down from R towards the event horizon, R plus, and integrate that essentially over the time of the in-spiral. And we calculate the energy and angular momentum, SR is super radiantly extracted from our spinning black hole. It depends on chi, which is this dimensionless spin I was describing by A. Dagger, and R, the distance inwards that the test particle has migrated. And it turns out that this extraction of mass and angular momentum from the black hole is exerting a negative torque on the black hole, just like radiation exerted a negative torque on the black hole when Kip calculated a somewhat similar limit back in 1974. And so we're doing a different negative torque, the same positive torque due to the mass freely falling in from the ISCO. And so we should have a different limit for maximum black hole spins. Again, just to continue the analogy, here, this is the slide I showed you before. There's a positive torque due to matter falling inward from the ISCO. There's a negative torque due to this radiation. And the maximum spin is established where they balance. This is Kip's calculation. In our calculation, here we're showing the energy and angular momentum super radiantly extracted from the hole as a function of the black hole spin. There's a green, blue, black, and red curves on this plot. These correspond to black holes whose spins are 0.996, 997, 998, and 999. As you increase the spin of the black hole, the ISCO moves inwards, which is why more highly spinning curves extend down to smaller r. And also the total amount of energy and angular momentum extracted increases as well. So we see, for example, for a hole of a spin 0.999, by the time you've in-spiraled all the way from large radii down to the ISCO, you've extracted from the black hole an energy that's almost 2% of the rest mass energy of your test particle. This is this is not the binding energy of the test particle, which is also radiated to infinity, but actually energy from the spinning hole itself.
You're saying that the hole has spun up the particle.
Essentially, yes, the hole is spinning, the rotation frequency of the horizon of the black hole is faster than the orbital frequency of the black hole. So it's very similar to the Earth is rotating faster than the Moon. The Earth rotates once a day, the Moon goes around once a month. So the Earth is spinning up the Moon's orbit, the Earth is transferring angular momentum to the Moon. This is a somewhat similar thing, that the spinning black hole is spinning up the test particle. Or essentially, from our perspective, the test particle is spinning down the black hole. By extracting energy, you lower the mass and increase the dimensionless spin. Whereas by extracting angular momentum, you're just directly lowering the angular momentum, directly lowering the spin. So these two effects are kind of competing to determine how the final dimensionless spin chi is changing per unit Q, per unit test particle mass accreted. And it turns out that the analog to this torque balance here is where the positive torque due to the mass gained once you fall in from the ISCO, which is shown by this horizontal line, is equal to the negative torque due to these two effects, which is shown by these curving lines. Horizontal curve and this non-horizontal curve intersect at the ISCO for a spin of 0.998. So it actually is surprising, but we find that due to gravitational radiation, this very different calculation, we've reestablished that same limit that Kip set. We've shown that you couldn't spin up above 0.998 with gaseous accretion, and you can't do it either by building your black hole from test particles. That's what we've seen. This is the same plot I showed before. Bardeen showed you spinning all the way up to unity. Kip showed that depending on your choice of radiation, you could spin up to a value around 0.998. We showed with gravitational radiation, again, depending on your spin, you can spin up. If you're very highly spinning, you spin down. But again, you asymptote to a dimensionless spin around 0.998. So this is a calculation we did using black hole perturbation theory for test particles. Remember, we took the Einstein's equation and turned it into the Tucholsky equation, black hole perturbation theory. Surprisingly, we can extrapolate these test particle mergers to more comparable mass mergers and try to make predictions about the final spins resulting from comparable mass mergers as well. The tool of choice for really studying these comparable mass mergers properly is numerical relativity. numeric relativity, I'm sure you've heard about it to some extent. It's really, it's just in its infancy. Franz Pretorius in 2005 successfully was able to merge two black holes for the very first time numerically. Here we see a series of later simulations by Marinetti et al. From 2008. What you are looking at here is for equal mass black holes, whose spins are aligned with the orbital angular momentum. They can either, as we said before, there's a maximum spin limit, S over M squared. This is this dimensionless spin we've been talking about. The magnitude of this thing, the maximum magnitude, is 1. If it's anti-aligned, we're assuming that if the spins of the two individual equal mass black holes are anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum, that's what we're calling minus 1. If they're positively aligned with the orbital angular momentum, we're considering that 1. And we see as a function of the spin magnitude, what is the final spin of the black hole? It seems like you can smoothly extrapolate to large values, but you can't get all the way to the maximally spinning limit. It's proven very difficult to construct initial data corresponding to initial conditions corresponding to nearby maximally spinning black holes. And people think they have a handle on it for spins around 0.9 or so, but you can't push to this maximally spinning limit. So it seems at first glance it would be difficult to compare this numerical relativity. Sorry.
Do you know what's the obstacle is being
by this one? Different people will tell you different things. This is very much, I mean, the codes are being written, new conditional conditions are being developed all the time. I think some of the initial data they use is conformally flat, which is it's known that the Kerr metric is not actually conformally flat. I think some of, you know, there's a variety of different things. Finding horizons when you have maximally spinning black holes in the code is difficult to do. It seems when if you take your naive guesses of what should correspond to maximally spinning black holes that are near each other and put them in and evolve them in numerical relativity, it turns out that what you're evolving is not stable maximally spinning black holes, but actually lower spinning black holes with a lot of junk radiation, with a lot of perturbations on top of them. So when people try to make guesses as what a maximally spinning hole should look like and try to run it, they find that on very short timescales, the hole spins down to some lesser value. Yeah.
So then there's this there was this famous analytic solution for the initial data, where the initial data you want to specify the extent of curvature and then the three metric, where the only thing you need to solve for numerically is one function, but everything else is done analytically. And that's this so-called Bowen-York initial data. And then it involves assuming that the initial data is conformally flat and it makes the codes easier. So all I think almost basically every binary simulation has been done so far still uses.
They have done head-on mergers that spins above the Bowen-York limit.
Okay.
The Caltech-Cornell recently has done this. I don't think it's published yet.
Formally, in the Bowen-York data, you can take these parameters that look like the spin and mass and send the spin to infinity. But still, when you calculate the physical spin, it's still only the asymptotes 2.9 of the maximum value. So
you're saying that formalism rests on the point time?
That solution.
This is a way. Yeah, a technique to construct the initial data for these numerical relativities.
Isn't it like a problem that you're too close to the singularity, basically,
I don't know if it's. I know with the asymptotic horizons, the apparent horizons that they use to try to identify where the horizons are when they're running their simulations. The Caltech-Cornell group does this excision technique where they excise the singularity. Obviously, simulating singularity is troublesome. The apparent horizons lie between the inner and outer horizons of a curved black hole. And then the limit that your spins approach 1, these two horizons, at least in the coordinates that they, in the one choice of coordinates, approach each other, which makes it difficult to kind of squeeze the apparent horizon between them. There's a number of different problems. It's kind of a complicated subject.
I think just this past year, the Harold Pfeiffer paper that was like for a single black hole had initial data that after it radiated away the junk still was spinning at like 0.99.
Progress is being made, but certainly in published work. And also, there seems to be more trouble too with simulating head on mergers versus quasi circular mergers. And again, I don't fully understand why that's true. But it is certainly true that in the published literature, there are no reliable simulations with dimensionless spins above 0.9. So it seems at first glance that this numerical relativity, comparable mass ratios, all the mass ratios that have been simulated so far have been, I define Q to be M2 over M1, it's the mass of the smaller hole over the mass of the larger hole, so it's defined to be less than 1. All these simulations so far have had mass ratios greater than 0.1, just because it's much more, numerically, you need more resolution to resolve a small black hole if you're trying to do an unequal mass ratio merger, and there's more orbits per unit increase in frequency as you inspiral. So these two effects make it essentially quadratic in the mass ratio, the amount of computational resources it takes. So a 10-to-1 merger is 100 times more intensive than a 1-to-1 merger. And even a 1-to-1 merger, if you're careful about doing convergence tests and stuff, can take 10,000 CPU hours or more to run. So it's very computationally intensive to run these numeric relativity simulations. So at first glance, it seems very difficult to compare the calculation we did before in the test particle limit for very highly spinning black holes with this, which is comparable mass ratio mergers at spins less than this maximum limit. However, just because it's difficult to make this comparison doesn't mean no one's tried to do so. And so fortune favors bold people that try to extrapolate their predictions. Scott Hughes and Roger Blanford back in 2003 made this pretty much simplest guess you could get, assume for the final mass and final spin of their black holes. They assumed that the mass of their final hole is just the mass of a large black hole plus the mass of the second black hole at the ISCO. And the spin is just the spin of the large black hole plus the orbital angular momentum brought in by the test particle of mass M2 at the ISCO. This is essentially the exact same Bardeen result that we saw back in 1970. But unlike Bardeen, who was saying it's only strictly valid in the test particle limit, Scott and Roger looked at ratios M2 over M1 as large as 0.3 and just tried to make, you can make predictions this way. Observationally, it's still unclear. And back in 2003, before numerical relativity developed, this was as good a guess as any for what you could make. Or perhaps that's not true, but it's a simple guess you could make in 2003. In 2008, Alessandro Bonanno, Larry Kidder, and Luis Lehner, who is, I think, affiliated with PI, did a different short guess. They assumed that their final black prediction for the final mass was just the sum of the masses of their black holes, and the spin is just the sum of the spins of the black holes, plus again the orbital angular momentum at the ISCO. So this guess is seems better than this one at first glance, because this one has a nice property that it's symmetric under exchanging the labels 1 and 2. It makes sense if you're merging comparable mass black holes, which hole is wet black hole 1, which hole is black hole 2, that's kind of an artificial distinction. And also, which hole is at the ISCO of the other hole? The whole notion of an ISCO is defined for the Kerr metric for a single black hole. And so they made the, if you try to say which single black hole looks most like the space-time during a binary black hole merger, they made the guess that the black hole you want to consider is not either of the initial black holes, but the final black hole. Ultimately, you are going to settle down once the merger is complete to some final black hole with some final dimensionless spin. So they actually iteratively proposed that, unlike here where we have final quantities on the left, initial quantities on the right, they actually said, why don't we have, again, final quantities on the left, but now we consider the orbital angular momentum about a final black hole of dimensionless spin pi final. And this, even though it looks a little bit counterintuitive at first, can be mathematically solved in a very straightforward way. And this was very successful. I was very impressed by how successful this was and wanted to see if we could improve it even further. So first I considered a symmetric choice to include the binding energy of your black holes at the ISCO before they merge, back in 2008. And now, considering the super radiant scattering that we talked about earlier, we can consider how the fact that you're extracting energy and angular momentum from the black hole changes your predictions for the final spins and masses. So this is showing, here we're comparing, so there's probably about 100 or more, I guess now 150, different numerical relativity simulations of merging black holes that are available in the literature. For the purposes of this part of the talk, we're only considering aligned spins. I looked at three different numerical relativity simulations, NRs, numerical relativity. The initial spins we're considering, these are equal mass black holes with spins aligned or anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum. Positive is aligned, negative is anti-aligned. Two of these are done with the Caltech Cornell numerical relativity code, which is among the more accurate ones out there. And it's actually very impressive to see the kind of accuracy that they claim now in terms of predicting the final spins you achieve. And this is, we said before, you cannot actually merge maximally spinning black holes, but this is based on the extrapolation of that smooth curve we saw earlier. This is a paper by Marinetti et al. In, I think, 2008. Their prediction for what the final spin of a maximally spinning black hole should be based on this extrapolation. And we see here, we're comparing these numerical relativity defined values to KLP, Kesden, Lockhart, Finney. This is our prediction based accounting for this new superradiant attraction of energy and angular momentum. K is my earlier prediction I showed you on the previous slide. BKL, Bonomican or later, that's their earlier prediction. And then these are several different predictions based on calibrating to numerical relativity. So this is saying what they do is you do a bunch of numerical relativity simulations. You come up with a fitting formula for what the final spin should be as a function of the initial spins and the mass ratio of the two holes. And if you calibrate the coefficients in that formula with numerical relativity, you could hope that it could be valid, be very good at interpolating and valid even at extrapolating beyond the limits of numerical relativity simulations. And we see that, not surprisingly, the simulations that were explicitly calibrated using these simulations by definition agree. But we see that this test particle calculation that we did, extrapolating all the way up to equal mass mergers, which seems much further than you might expect it to go, gives you a prediction 0.686354, which is in agreement to almost a part in 10 to the 4 with the numerical relativity simulations. It's really surprising that it works so well. It is perhaps a coincidence, to be devil's advocate. We chose a different kind of extrapolation that had the same desirable symmetry properties, but the symmetry alone doesn't fully constrain how you extrapolate up to equal masses, and shown that you can get somewhat different values. So relying on this to this precision is probably not a good idea, but the fact that you can do such a good job suggests that the ultimate way to approach the problem of understanding, predicting final spins from black hole mergers will be to use numerical relativity simulations, which are very expensive, at comparable mass ratios, test particle calculations, which we know to be exact, at small mass ratios, and then interpolating between the two. And this is just a cautionary tale of what happens if you exclusively rely on numerical relativity. This is that same change in the dimensionless final spin per unit test particle mass that we talked about earlier. Here, chi I is the initial spin of our merging black holes. This is in the test particle limit. We see this blue result. This is the Bardeen result or the Hughes and Blanford results. That so chi FTQ is positive. Above zero, it's positive. That means you're spinning your black hole up all the way up to 1, the Kerr limit, and then it goes to 0 in that limit. This black solid curve is our new prediction, which shows you spin all the way up to this asymptotic spin of 0.98. And that's where the torque's balanced, so this is the maximum spin you can achieve. If you're not careful about numerical relativity, if you extrapolate all the way downward to this limit and trust it there, these are suggesting that there are positive torques all the way beyond curve. So this is suggesting, if you're not careful about about worrying about what's going on in the test particle limit, numerical relativity could be predicting super curve spins in parts of the parameter space. So that's the end of the first, I guess, three quarters of the talk. We showed that the Kerr metric allows solutions as large as chi or A star equal to 1. Astrophysical black holes won't have spins this high. Their spins will depend on how they form. Kipp showed in 1974 that if you build up a black hole by accretion in an equatorial thin accretion disk, you can't reach a maximum spin of 1, but you reach a limit 0.998. We showed building a black hole by a seemingly very different method, binary black hole mergers in the test particle limit, you reach essentially the same limit of 0.998. And we also showed that black hole perturbation theory, which is strictly valid only in the test particle limit, can be a valuable tool for predicting the final spins from black hole mergers of comparable mass ratios. Latham?
Do people think that they will be able to, so you were saying that 0.998, actually in terms of binding energy, is a significant difference.
For yeah.
Is that difference significant enough that people think they'll be able to, like with iron K alkalines or something, see things that are more?
There's two different. So number one, you're saying, well, does it?
Can people?
There's we see black holes. We see things we think are stellar mass black holes. We see supermassive black holes. There are numerous astrophysical ways that you would attempt to determine the black hole spin. Latham was talking about iron K alpha lines. This is a reverberation mapping is a technique for, you look at time variations in an accretion flow and see, depending on how they propagate outward through a disk, you could determine where the ISCO is in that disk and hence what the spin of the black hole is. I don't know if people, what?
I think another thing they do is just take the spectrum and they have some, it gets red, you know, part of it gets red because it's presumed to come from very close in and cuts off somewhere.
Looking at the position of the cutoff, as we said before, the location of the ISCO depends on the spin as well. So based on an argument like that, if you could determine where the ISCO was as a function of R, you could determine the spin of the hall. Do people think that they could actually, with those techniques, distinguish 0.998 from 1? Not currently. I don't know ultimately what's limiting them. I think determining spins with that accuracy that way would be really hard to do. But it's certainly possible that something like LIGO or LISA could determine spins with this kind of accuracy. And also, people already get to the point, astronomers get to the point where there's this Sultan argument that is trying to say, you look at we have a census of the total number of supermassive black holes in the universe. We measure the quasar luminosity function and have a census of the total amount of radiation produced in quasars. So then we can try to say, what is the mean spin of black holes? What is the efficiency of that radiation if it's produced from AGN, and hence what is the spin? Spinning black holes are more efficient at converting the accreted matter into radiation, and so for those arguments, the difference between 0.3 and 0.4 is several percent. It's a factor of a few. It's a factor of 30%. So it could be significant for those kinds of arguments. So this is the end of the first three quarters of the talk, and I'll try to be brief in the second part. Do we have any questions? We can have questions at the end of the talk too, as well.
I have actually one. How long does it take to reach that spin?
How long does it take to reach what?
0.998.
You mean how long in terms of what? How much mass does it take to?
You said how much mass it takes. You didn't say how long.
Well, we're assuming if the stuff is moving in through gravitational radiation and then falls in from the ISCO, the more test particles you have coming in, the faster it will. You could say, you have to grow. It doesn't change dramatically. Depends on you're asymptoting to depending on how close you want to get to 0.998. You still have this. What the Eddington limit is? So you're growing your mass by an e-folding in something like, is it 200 million years for the Eddington limit? Depends on the efficiency. Something like that. So if you grow your mass by a factor of rad 6 is not many e-folding. So yeah, if you were growing test particles from a non-spinning black hole, it would take several hundred million years.
So for that question of the time scale, like 0.998 and 1
No, I mean, I think you're asymptoting it, so it could take a very long time to get very close to it. But I think, there's not huge changes in getting near 0.998 versus getting near 1. You don't have to be accreting at Eddington, that's an upper bound in your accretion. It could take a lot longer if you're accreting at sub-Eddington. So the second half of this talk is going to involve spin precession. Whereas before we were looking at, we wanted to see what is the biggest spin you could achieve. So if you want to make a big spin, the way to do it is to line up the spin of your final black hole is essentially going to be the sum of the initial spins plus the orbital angular momentum at merger. So if you want to add vectors and get a big final vector, you want to line all those vectors up. However, astrophysically, there's no reason to say these have to be lined up. And it turns out, furthermore, that the numerical relativity simulations I described before showed that the final spin of the black hole and these recoils, which I briefly alluded to, the fact that if you preferentially emit gravitational radiation in one direction, your final black hole will recoil in another direction, the magnitude of the recoils, the magnitude of the final spins, depend sensitively on the relative orientation of the black hole of the initial black hole spins at merger. And they don't have to be aligned. Bogdanovich et al. In a paper of 2007 argued that in the case of binary black hole merger, we consider the thing that's driving the merger is gravitational radiation. You radiate energy and angular momentum to infinity. It's extracted from the orbit, and the black holes then spiral and merge. But that scales as a steep power of the separation of the black holes. If the black holes are too widely separated, it'll take over a Hubble time for them to inspiral and merge. So you need something to escort the black holes close enough together that the merger time is shorter than the Hubble time. And that something in for astrophysical black holes is believed to be dynamical friction, either off of stars or off of a circumbinary disk. And Bogdanovich showed that if you have a gaseous circumbinary disk, the same kind of that you need for the dynamical friction to get the black holes close to each other, torques between the spinning black holes and the disk will tend to align the spins with the orbital angular momentum. However, this is a messy astrophysical problem. The efficiency of this alignment, the efficiency of how closely aligned the spins of your initial black holes and the orbital angular momentum will be, depends on the nature of the circumbinary disk, which is still somewhat uncertain. Dottie et al. Did a series of simulations for cold and hot, thin alpha accretion disks that showed that it could vary for between 10 and 30 degrees, but that's certainly not a... There are other accretion flows that could make it even more of a misalignment. And so the general thing is that we had dynamical friction getting our black holes close together. Once they get close enough, gravitational radiation takes all over and causes them to inspiral and merge. If the spins are misaligned, once gravitational radiation takes over, the black hole spins will precess many times before they merge, and you need to take that precession into account before you want to compare with your numerical relativity simulations, which begin at very small separations.
I thought the point of what you did with Layton was that there isn't many precessions.
We were looking at the fact that we had this spin expansion for black hole kicks and final spins, yeah, which showed that just based on parity and exchange symmetries, your final spins and kicks or recoils cannot depend on arbitrary components of the spins. They only depend on a restricted number of spins. But it doesn't mean that there isn't precession at large separations. We were just looking at numerical relativity simulations, which begin at small separations, that have just a few orbits before merger. Whereas in fact, gravitational radiation takes over at separations of around 1,000 m, which is many, many orbits before merger. And many precessions can occur during that part of the inspiral.
Okay, because I remember I specifically asked Layton this, and he said that there aren't that many precessions.
There are not that many precessions
I asked whether it's a chaotic, the precession is chaotic, and his response was, no, it's not chaotic. That's why you have this interpolation problem, like the Taylor expansion. But maybe we should move on.
Why don't we move on?
Yeah.
There was not a lot of precession between the small separation at which numerical relativity simulations begin, and that Latham and I used as initial conditions for our Bing formula,
yeah,
and the merger. But astrophysically, gravitational radiation takes over at much larger separations, and there is significant precession, you know, during that much longer post-Newtonian
interval. So you calculate that numerically, or analytically, basically.
Right, exactly. You calculate it basically by evolving a couple differential equations, which is much more kind of cheaper to do than real numerical relativity. So this kind of stage of the inspiral that we're interested in, from separations of 1,000 m, where gravitational radiation takes over from these gaseous torques, down to 10 m, where the post-Newtonian approximation breaks down, and you really need to rely on numerical relativity. During this post-Newtonian stage of the inspiral, there's a hierarchy of timescales that helps us understand the problem. The shortest timescale of the problem is just the orbital time, the time for two black holes to orbit each other. That scales as the separation to the 3/2 power. Tau squared goes as r cubed. This is Kepler's law that we all know. The precession time is the time for a spin to precess some axis, and that goes as r to the 5/2. And finally, the longest time scale in the problem, the longest time scale, is the inspiral time. That's the time it takes for gravitational radiation to carry away energy and angular momentum from the system and cause the binary to merge. So at large r, at r of 1,000 m or so, there's a clear hierarchy between the short orbital time scale, the intermediate precession time, and the long inspiral time. And that helps simplify the analysis. Since the orbital time is short compared to the precession time, we can consider the orbit average precession of the black holes. So here we show S1 and S2 is the spin of black hole 1, the spin of black hole 2. Remember that black hole 1 was the more massive hole. And this is just the differential equation for precession. Spin 1 and spin 2 are precessing about these precession vectors, omega 1 and omega 2, which are shown here. Q is the mass ratio of the two holes. It's m2 divided by m1. It's defined to be less than 1. Ln is the Newtonian orbital angular momentum. And so here we see for generic misaligned black holes, the orbital angular momentum, the two holes are spinning about different directions, and they're spinning with these magnitudes. And this is manifestly symmetric under exchanging 1 and 2, which is what you'd like. That's how the spins are precessing. What is the orbital angular momentum doing? Well, because the precession time is short compared to the gravitational radiation time, you can assume that on the precession time scale, the total angular momentum J, which is the sum of the Newtonian angular momentum and the spins of the two black holes, the total J is conserved because there's nowhere for it to go when you're not considering gravitational radiation, and the magnitude of the orbital angular momentum is conserved. So if J is conserved, then dj dt is zero, and that implies that dl dt is just minus ds dt. Here s is the sum of the two spins, and this is essentially just the inverse of the magnitude of L. This is the magnitude of L, this is its inverse. So this is how the orbital angular momentum is precessing. And finally, on that longest time scale, the radiation reaction time scale, the orbital frequency is slowly increasing. Omega is the orbital frequency. Omega dot is positive, it's slowly increasing. And as omega increases, the orbital angular momentum decreases. So this is the slow in-spiral of the black holes, the decrease in the magnitude of the orbital angular momentum. These are the post-Kurtanian equations we use to describe the spin precession and orbital angular momentum precession during the stage of convergence.
So the magnitude of S is not changed?
The magnitudes of the individual spins don't change, that's true.
To the order that you
use? Yes, to the order, to the post-Kurtanian order we use. I don't even know if any, it's a very high order, the changing magnitude.
But the problem is that you can keep redefining spin or if I order to make it zero.
I guess so. I mean, connecting at very high order, you're going to start having trouble relating the spins of the two black holes to individual curve spins, I suppose. This is a standard treatment. These are kind of.
But the problem is that you have a very long time to the merger, right?
Right.
The terms that are. So the precession happens very fast.
Right.
But then there are lots of precessions before that black hole actually merges.
Right.
But I think in that time scale, I think the magnitude of the spin could also change because the terms that you're ignoring could.
I think that the spins in. This is, I guess, maybe we should talk about this at the end of the talk. This is a standard treatment we haven't developed. I think you're right that the radiation reaction is kind of a high PN order compared to the spin precession. I think even on the PN order of the radiation reaction, people have not found a change in the spin magnitudes, unlike the spin directions. And so as we this paper by Bogdanovich, 2007, that I alluded to before, they considered the exact same post-Newtonian treatment that we did. They took, this is a situation we're considering. Ln is the orbital angular momentum of the binary. Assume it points along the z-axis. S1 and S2 are the spins of our two black holes. Theta1 is the angle that spin 1 makes with the orbital angular momentum. Theta2 is the angle that spin 2 makes with the orbital angular momentum. And theta 1 2 is the angle between spin 1 and spin 2. And delta phi is phi 2 minus phi 1. We're just assuming this is the z-axis, and theta and phi are just your traditional spherical coordinates. What Bogdanovich showed in 2007 was they took the same post-Newtonian treatment that I just described, took 1,000 binaries, each dot in this picture is a binary, at a separation of 1,000 m, assumed a flat distribution in cos theta, which is what you'd expect for isotropically oriented spins, flat distribution in cos theta 1, flat distribution in cos theta 2, evolved these 1,000 dots, these 1,000 binaries, in from a large separation of 1,000 m to a smaller separation of 10 m, took a look at this and said, these points are pretty much isotropically distributed in this plot. Gravitational radiation cannot align our spins. And so if you want to try to line our spins up with the orbital angular momentum, which is something people have been seeking to do to avoid very large gravitational recoils, as I'm going to describe very shortly, you have to rely on gas. That gravitational radiation alone can't get the job done. But we wanted to look a little more carefully. Because 1,000 m, while it seems from relativity perspective it's a large separation, certainly in terms of numerical relativity, that's a large separation. From an astrophysical perspective, 1,000 m, even for supermassive black holes, is very subparsec scales. It's well below the resolution that any kind of simulation has. All these torque effects that Bogdanovich is considering are essentially the initial conditions for this post-Newtonian stage of the N-spiral. And so what we did is we repeated, again, for the exact same case that Bogdanovich just considered in the previous slide. Here, this is cos theta 1 on the x-axis, cos theta 2 on the y-axis. And we have a flat distribution, but now we've color-coded the points. There's 1,000 points on these plots, just like Bogdanovich had in the previous slide. Here, this is essentially a 10 by 10 grid. And then there's 10 points with different values of delta phi, one on top of each other here. We begin our inspiraling our binaries at a separation a little bit above 1,000 m. Inspiral to 1,000 m, down to 100 m, and then to a final separation of 10 m. And what we see is these points are spreading out, but they're spreading out on a line. And this line is such that such that a certain quantity, S0.ln, is conserved. This is the projection of a weighted sum of the spins, S1 and S2 are black hole spins, Q is the mass ratio, M2 over M1. The component of this weighted sum, S0, in the direction of the orbital angular momentum is conserved during the merger, which is why these points are essentially on the precession time oscillating back and forth along this line. And so as you inspiral from 1,000 m down to 10 m, you have many precessions. You oscillate back and forth along on these lines, and these partially aligned blue points, which represent a more realistic set of astrophysical conditions where one of your spins has been partially aligned with the orbital angular momentum, rather than staying segregated where you thought they'd be at this very small separation, they spread out into a different part of the plane. Again, remember these colors because you're going to see them in future slides. The blue points just assumes that at 1,000 m, theta 1 is small, hence cos theta 1 is near 1. The green of the intermediate points and the red of the points where spin 1 is nearly anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum. Theta 1 is near pi, cos theta 1 is near minus 1. That's what blue and red mean, and that's what they're going to mean for the rest of the dot. So it turns out not only are these points in terms of theta 1, 2 migrating throughout the plot, but the spins are aligning with each other or anti-aligning with each other. These are the red, green, and blue points we just saw on the previous slide. Again, this is the same. This is above 1,000 m, 1,000 m, 100 m, 10 m. But now, instead of looking at theta 1 and theta 2 on the xy axis, we're looking at delta phi. This is the angle between the projections of the two spins in the orbital plane. It's the same just spherical coordinates, theta 2 minus theta 1. And on this axis, we have cos theta 1, 2, the cosine of the angle between the two spins. And we see that red and blue and green are different choices for what spin of black hole 1 is doing. But since spin of black hole 2 is still completely random, even if I pick one particular direction on the sky, if the second spin is entirely random, you'd again expect a flat distribution in the cosine of the angle between them. And you'd expect it would be symmetric for the red and the blue points. And it is initially. But due to spin precession, there's a segregation of the red and the blue points. You see that the blue points, which is the case where the spin of the more massive black hole is nearly aligned with the orbital angular momentum, are clustered in this part of the plot. This is delta phi equals 0. They're aligned in the orbital plane. And cos theta 1, 2 equals 1. So that's when, again, theta 1, 2 is 0. So the blue points are lining up. The spins are lining up with each other. The red points are clustered here, which is, you know, delta phi is plus or minus 180, which is the same thing. Cosine theta 1, 2 is minus 1. So if the spin of the more massive hole is initially partly aligned with Ln, that means theta 1 initially is small. The holes line up with each other. If theta 1 is initially big, the spins anti-align with each other. This was first noticed by Jeremy Schnittman in a paper in 2004. You can see that again in a histogram. Here are these dotted curves, also for the rest of this talk, and we're almost done. Dotted curves are going to be a distribution at 1,000 m, which is what we use for our initial condition. Solid curves are a distribution at 10 m, which is the final, you know, the final in-spiral radius that we stopped at. And we see at 1,000 m, we have flat distributions in cosine theta 1, 2, flat distributions in delta 5. The black set is for all 1,000 binaries we considered. The blue ones, again, are the ones where the spin 1 is partly aligned with Ln. The red ones are when spin 1 is anti-aligned with Ln. They start out with flat distributions, as shown by the dotted curves. By the time you inspiral to 10 m, whereas the black distribution, the overall isotropic distribution, is still flat within Poisson noise, the partly aligned cases are now biased for, towards cosine theta 1, 2 equals 1. The red ones are anti-aligned, both in cos theta 1, 2 and delta 5. Here we're looking at a mass ratio of 9/11, so nearly equal mass word ratio, which is where these spin alignment effects are most powerful. Here we're looking at a mass ratio of 1/3. And there is still a small effect, but it's harder to distinguish. So mostly the spin alignment occurs from near equal mass ratios down to mass ratios of about 1/3 or so. And this spin alignment dramatically changes the distribution of affected final spins and recoils that you'll expect near merger. Here we see, looking again at these blue points, the dotted curve shows this distribution. When we consider an n-spiral down to 10 m, a post-Newtonian n-spiral, alignment lines up the spins with each other, giving you larger final spins. This solid curve is peaked towards higher values. If you look at different angles, if you look at angles where the misalignment is, where theta 1, rather than just being some subset of this isotropic distribution, is fixed to be initially, the purple curve is theta 1 of 10 degrees at 1,000 m, the blue curve is 20 degrees, the green curve is 30 degrees, which is motivated by the hydro simulations people had carried out. We see that the dotted distribution is pretty flat from spins ranging from 0.7 to near 1. If we take into account this post-Newtonian stage of the inspiral, the spins align and you get much more highly spinning final hulls. We're going to skip talking about spin directions and go finally to the recoil velocities that I mentioned. The recoil velocities are due to the fact that gravitational radiation is emitted in one direction. The black holes recoil in another direction. The magnitude of that recoil can approach 4,000 kilometers per second, which is very troubling. 4,000 kilometers per second, though, you know, about 1% the speed of light, compared to the escape velocity of actual galaxies, is large. And so people worry, if black holes routinely merge and recoil with velocities of 4,000 kilometers per second, how come we see black holes at the center of every galaxy? How come these black holes haven't been kicked out? There's numerous contributions to these recoils, but the biggest contribution is due to the spin of the black holes and due to a weighted difference in those spins. As Lazen and I showed in that paper that you alluded to, by symmetry you can show that this is one particular formula that was developed by one of the numerical relativity groups. But you can even show more generally that just on symmetry grounds alone, recoils have to be proportional, at least at linear order, to the difference in the spins. And so the dominant effect of the post-Newtonian inspiral I've been describing is to align spins with each other, which is to make their difference less. So if we look at histograms of the kicks, whereas even if we align the more massive spin with the orbital angular momentum, nearly align it with amounts of 10, 20, and 30 degrees, since the second spin is randomly oriented, you can still get large kicks with tails extending to several thousand kilometers per second, well above the escape velocity from galaxies. If you include this post-Newtonian alignment, the spins align with each other, the dotted distributions, which is telling you what the kicks would be based on the spins at 1,000 m, compared to the solid curves, the kick distribution expect from the spin alignments at 10 m, these are peaked at much smaller values. You get a reduction in the, this is as a function of the mass ratio of the two hulls, and depending on the alignment of the spin of the more massive hull at 1,000 m, this is the velocity you'd predict from those spin distributions at 1,000 m. If you allow those spins to align, these are the smaller velocities you'd expect. And this can be the difference between kicking a black hole out with the recoil of 864 and keeping it in your galaxy. So I think I'm going to conclude because I'm already over time. The point of the second part of the talk was that misaligned spins, which is what you generically respect, expect, will process many times as they inspiral from 1,000 m when gravitational radiation takes over down to 10 m. Although isotropic distributions remain isotropic, consistent with earlier people's findings, that's not the appropriate initial conditions for mergers that have gas, even at 1,000 m. And you need gas, or you need some form of dynamical friction to get those black holes close enough together. The post-Newtonian equations that I described imply the spins will align if the more massive spin is partly aligned with the orbital angular momentum at 1,000 m. And this, the effect of this alignment will significantly alter your predicted distribution of final spins. You increase the final spins by aligning the spins with each other and decrease the recoil velocities. Okay, so that's basically what I wanted to say today. Thanks a lot for your time.
In that final plot, I think you maybe said it.
I was pretty quick, yes.
Are these initial spin distributions and Q? Oh, Q is not on.
Yeah, if you look at the letter that I put out a week ago, Monday, I guess, you know, whatever, 8 days ago, we have plots and also tables for different mass ratios and different spin magnitudes. These are for maximum spins. We also show results for 0.75, 0.5, and 0.25. It's just a histogram of the kick velocities.
So even though it looks like there's still a significant number of, a significant number of kicks at 1,000 kilometers per second or something?
For maximally spinning holes. And these
for maximally spinning nearly equal mass. So if for a real distribution, you predict that there's basically almost no holes.
Yeah, like for example, here we're looking, so this is 9/11, which is what's shown in this plot. There's other plots in my paper. I just couldn't show too many plots in the talk. If you look at mass ratios of 2/3 or 1/3, again for maximally spinning holes, the kick velocities go down. You still have, you know, the effect of the alignment peters out for small mass ratios, but you don't need alignment because you're naturally going to have small kicks. This alignment is most significant for highly spinning holes, but it doesn't have to be very highly spinning. As long as your spin is above 0.5 or so, you get significant alignment. And for holes whose mass ratios are, they don't have to be exactly 1, but 2/3, 9/11, close to 1. So this spin, and you see here that 2/3, we're going down from a median of kick of 724 to a median kick of 283. This is a big effect. This is like a factor of
3
or so. Yeah, 3 or so. You get the biggest effect precisely for the highest spinning, nearly equal mass holes that you'd be most worried about. So you're right. I mean, you're right. It doesn't completely eliminate these large kicks. Even in this most extreme case of maximally spinning, nearly equal mass, it dramatically reduces them. So it's not impossible, just significantly less likely. Any other questions?
So, I think maybe you went over it somewhat quickly. Quite get the idea of what you're doing here, that you think that the isotropic distribution remains isotropic, but somehow, if it's not quite isotropic, then...
Right. So people had shown, before we did our study, people had looked. Remember, I had shown this Bogdanovich.
Yeah, yeah.
Plot. I don't need to show it. It's just basically a flat plot. So they said if you assume that both spins are isotropic at 1,000 m, inspiral a set of 1,000 binaries down to 10 m, and looked at what is the distribution of spin orientations down at 10 m, they're still isotropic. So you wouldn't. So just looking at an isotropic distribution, you'd think this precession, while it's occurring, is just ergodically shifting stuff all around. It's not changing the actual distribution. It's not something that's going to help me avoid these large kicks. But 1,000 m, which is, well, the starting point for the post-Newtonian relativity, is essentially the ending point for astrophysics. And you wouldn't expect, only in maybe the most gas-poor mergers where you somehow wear stellar dynamical friction on its own was sufficient to get the things close to merger. Generally, there's going to be gas around when galaxies merge. That gas will partly align the spins with the orbital angular momentum, not fully align them. And so those partly aligned distributions, which are what are shown by the blue and the red curves, all of these other colored distributions are partly aligned distributions. Those stay part, you know, they process in different ways as they inspiral from 1,000 m to 10 m. And the point I'm making is that they process in ways to change the distributions of final spins and final kicks that you'd expect.
Is it also fair? So they were saying that the spins ended up isotropic with respect to the direction of the orbital angular momentum. But if you ask, how does spin one end up with respect to spin two?
I think those are also, they're all, those are, you're saying, what are, they looked at just spot theta 1 and theta 2, what are delta phi and theta 1, 2 doing?
Aren't you finding that they're full to the poles?
They're not, and I do, this is something that is certainly worthy of further inquiry. So here this is showing the blue curves. Okay, so if you look at the black, this is cos theta 1, 2 and delta phi. This is for the mass ratio of 9/11, so this is for a mass ratio of a third.
Can you remind us what theta 1, 2 is?
Theta 1, 2 is the angle between spin 1 and spin 2.
Okay.
And delta phi is just the angle between phi 1 and phi 2 that's, you know, projected into the orbital plane. The black distribution, this is an isotropic distribution. Within shot noise, this is still flat. We should do more simulations. It takes, even on a, we have a small cluster at CETUS, at Caltech. Surprisingly, Caltech does not have huge clusters at our beck and call. And also, we're in spiraling from 1000M, which is a larger separation than other people consider, so it takes us longer. The blue ones certainly are clustering towards one pole. The red ones are clustering towards another pole. But if you sum the blue, the red, and those green points, which I just didn't show for clarity on this plot, they would add up to these black distributions. So somehow, even though partly aligned things are, you know, aligning or anti-aligning, the overall effect of an isotropic distribution is to cancel this out. But no one has shown kind of analytically why this should cancel out. I've certainly wondered about this question. It's certainly worth looking at more carefully. Shtipman didn't show this in his 2004 paper. If you could somehow show why all these things cancel out in this way, that would be very interesting. But if they see it, they seem to do so. Any other questions? All right, thanks a lot, guys.
So I guess for dinner, if anyone's interested, we'll meet in the...